Next order of business, so we have the agenda that we set last time that we'll go through today, but there were four very good questions that Bill had, so he's going to ask them in order, and then we'll answer them and or discuss them at your leisure, but I think they were good, thought-provoking questions, and were very relevant to the stuff we've been saying.
Great. I only have three, but if you say there are four, maybe you can split one into two. So the first one is, are we responsible for our circumstances? If so, then is someone not Christian enough if their circumstances are not ideal? And what circumstances matter, secular or spiritual?
Okay.
Second one is...
Well, we'll go one at a time, if that's all right with you.
Fine.
Okay, because I won't be able to remember. Are we responsible for our circumstances? Now, part of the reason they're asking this, for those that are new or just walking in this time, is what we're trying to do, we're in the middle of a series on science making you a better Christian, and whether being a Christian ought to make you a better scientist, which I would argue that it would. We have spent a couple years going through basically the proofs, starting from zero and assuming nothing about the Bible, assuming nothing about philosophy, etc. And we worked our way around to, at least in some opinions, arguing our way to, yes, God exists, yes, he's the God of the Bible, yes, he's the Trinitarian God, etc. We actually have laid out a case that I think Lang has put up on the webpage that shows all that. So we use that as an assumption. We're starting with that as an assumption, not because we wanted to just posit it axiomatically, but because we said we've made good arguments for that. But since we can't give 2 years' worth of arguments every class, we're going to have to refer you back to the earlier videos on that. In the meantime, what we have said is we know we want to do then what God says to do, because what do people want to be? They want to be happy, and they want to live forever. Ultimately, every fairy tale ends that way. That's the goal of mankind. Everybody knows they want to be happy. And all the things that we do, earning money, trying to do things in careers, having families, actually end up being targeted in many ways at our own happiness. We do things that make us happy. We all want to be happy. Christianity says the best way to be happy is to follow the commandments of God. Because if God does love you, and he is the smartest being in all of existence, then the combination of those two things, he both loves you and he knows you better than anything else, means that he is going to tell you what is going to make you happy. That it would be inconceivable for an all-loving God to say, I'm going to give you a bunch of orders, you need to follow these, but they're not going to make you happy. But I love you and I want you to be happy. It just doesn't make sense. If he loves you, he wants you to be happy. If he wants you to be happy and he knows how to be for you to be happy, he's going to tell you how to be happy. As it turns out, all of these orders, these are things to which we are to be obedient, are the things that will make us happy in the long run. The great thing about it is most people look at the Bible and they're like, it's this huge volume full of all of these books, and there's 66 of them, and you have to read them all to even know them, and there's prophets in there that I still can't list. And everybody turned to Hezekiah 4. Wait a second, there's no such thing as Hezekiah, but half the people probably would have tried to turn there. It's one of those kind of things of you almost give up, because when you do commit to reading the Bible, you get to Numbers, and then everybody stops. So that's if you made it through the genealogies in Genesis. God gave us the Cliff Notes version. A scribe asks Jesus, Rabbi, what is the greatest commandment? And he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, your mind, your soul. And the second is like it, love your neighbor as yourself. In these are all the law and the prophets. What he's saying is the Cliff Notes version of the whole Bible is love God and love other people. Now, there's more to it than that, but he's saying those are the greatest commandments that God gives. Now, if we are to be obedient, and when we see that Jesus even gave this commandment, Peter, do you love me? You know I do. Feed my sheep. That means love other people. Love the people specifically that Peter was in charge of. And he asked him that question 3 times. That being disciples of Christ means trying to obey him, among other things. But one of the things means is being disciplined to obey him. So the question is, how do we be disciplined to obey him? And we realized there were 2 problems. One is we have desires that are counter to that. And the second is we don't necessarily know all the things we're supposed to do. So what we have done for this class is we said there are 2 people that we want to love, God and others. And we're trying to figure out how to best do that. And what we said is when we get into this class, we'll talk some more specifically about this, but that's basically where we are today. Now the question is, in all of this, here we are, God holds us responsible in some ways for our circumstances. That's the question. Does he hold us responsible for our circumstances? Because it does seem like that answer might be yes and it might be no. And I don't want to be an equivocator, but I will say there's a little of both in there. There's a little of both in there. If This is my opinion, but this is, I'll give you the scriptures that I think that it's based on. God will not hold you responsible for, and I think of God as a father in this case. God will not hold you responsible for the world in which he puts you. Okay, if you're born in Kenya, or you're born in Georgia, or you're born in New York, or you're born in Norway, you're going to have some different, significantly different sets of circumstances, both in what the knowledge of God is in those areas, in what the socioeconomic things are in those areas, and the way the culture treats people in those areas. So you have certain things for which you are not responsible. Do you think God holds you, by show of hands, responsible for the part of the world into which you're born? Is he going to criticize you based on what you do? Possibly. Okay, we got one. One great soul will say yes. Do you as a father hold your child responsible, Peter, with Liam there? Would you hold Liam responsible for the household into which he is born? Why not?
It's not his fault.
Because he has no control over it.
Right.
Now that's interesting, and this is separate from here. When we talk about responsibility, we usually use the word control. Peter used it right off the bat. That which you control is that which is you're responsible for. If you're a soldier in World War II, rolling across the beaches of Normandy, and your buddy gets shot next to you, nobody holds you responsible for that, because that's outside of your control. There's some German machine gun nest that made that happen. But if you were a soldier and you failed to follow an order that would have destroyed the German machine gun nest and your buddy got shot, now you might walk away with some guilt for that because you didn't follow the order, because that was within your control. That control of what we control is what differentiates whether we have moral responsibility or not. Now, do some of our circumstances result from our own choices? Absolutely they do. In fact, past the whole, I've been born into Peter's household, as soon as he starts deciding what he wants to do and doesn't want to do, he's starting to shape his environment a little bit. Not the least of which is, if he turns out to be a baby who's very compliant and says to Peter, yeah, I'm going to obey everything that you do, how well disposed is Peter going to be to him? Probably pretty well. So what's the chances that he's going to be in a situation where his dad really feels like someone's towering over him and he wants to rebel against him? Low. Let's say that he spends a lifetime of shaking his fist in his dad's face, and let's say that his dad doesn't do a good job back at handling that kind of thing, and they end up with this adversarial relationship. Whose choices differentiated those two possibilities? Well, both in this case. It was both Liam and Peter because of the way they reacted to each other. So we would fault them both for that if we were sitting as outside judges. So, parts of your environment that you do not control, God will not hold you responsible for. We all know moral culpability stems from your choices, not ones that you cannot prevent. The parts of the environment that result from your choices are ones that God will hold you responsible for because they are your choice.
Yeah, I think of the story of Joseph and how it seemed like he was doing what he was supposed to be doing, but all the circumstances in his life were awful. And if, you know, for a long time, and if someone had looked at him and said, and just based his relationship or assumed his relationship with God off of his circumstances at that time, before the end result, you know, was realized, then they might think, oh, okay, well, he must not trust God or must not be obedient to God, when really he was in that situation because he was obedient to God.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. And that the nuances in here could occupy a whole bunch of classes in and of themselves. But the short answer to a good question is, the reason that there's a question about it is because the answer is both. But you differentiate the parts of the environment that were presented to you and the parts of the environment that you caused yourself. That's how I would answer that question. So, Chris, and if that's not satisfying, we can reattack another time. Question two.
Okay.
So this gets a little personal.
Fair enough.
So, too bad. And I've got to do both parts. So, question two. If our strongest desire is to be in a loving, reciprocal relationship, then how can that be reconciled as a twice-divorced man who wants a loving, reciprocal relationship without being an adulterer? And then that ties to, if the desire is adulterous because I'm divorced, then how do I change the desire to be in a loving, reciprocal relationship, and is that change unnatural from a secular and Christian view?
Okay. That question has a few nuances in it, so I'll get myself in trouble right off the bat. I do have an opinion about this. Now, in the same way that I have an opinion about this problem, that's like somebody, I use the military a lot because I'm an old Marine and I've been in the military my whole life, so they're easy analogies for me to give. It's one thing as a Marine, Carl's a Marine, as an example, when Carl says, you know, this is what it's like in the Marine Corps, I'm likely to listen to what he has to say. If somebody in the class that's never been in the Marines is like, this is what it's like in the Marine Corps, I'm probably going to question what they say a little bit more. My marriage, God, the circumstances God has presented me in my marriage are very, very easy. So any criticism that I give of another person's marriage is the worst kind of armchair quarterbacking. I just want to caveat that right now, right? So I can't say this is the way it is because I've walked a mile in your shoes and this is how it is. So if you don't like my answer, feel free to dismiss it as, that's great, kid. If you walked in my shoes, you'd have a different answer. So I'm going to pull, yes, ma'am.
Can you repeat the question?
Sorry, the question was in two parts. Basically, if we desire to love people the way that God says, I'm rephrasing, tell me if I've got it wrong. And God says, don't get divorced. Let's say that those two things are true. Then, as if I'm a divorced man, and I've remarried another woman, am I now biblically living in adultery? And if so, what am I supposed to do if I desire to be obedient to what I see as the command in the Bible? So it's a little bit of a nuanced question, but that's because it's got a lot of personal history behind it. Now, I'll give you one principle we have to lay out initially, and it's one that Paul leans on. I'm not saying that this is the case here, but remember, Paul is writing about the question, should I eat, is it okay to eat meat that has been sacrificed to idols? Generally speaking, at the time, the Jewish rabbinic understanding was absolutely not, you can't touch it, it's unholy, and God's people don't eat stuff that's unholy. Paul was turning around and saying, I'm using some other passages, in his case, stuff he'd heard orally from witnesses about what Jesus had said, to say, look, in reality, the eating of this meat doesn't make you unclean. But, if you think that it does, then for you it is sin. That is to say, if you knowingly do something that you think may be wrong, then what you're doing is saying, look, I think God, you may be wrong about whether God says to do it, but I think God says not to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. So even if you were wrong about eating meat, even if that's not a big deal, you have at least said, I'm going to rebel against what God says to do. Well, that we know is wrong. So for that reason, it would be wrong. So what I would say is to the man who's thinking about this that says, I don't know. I've got this one wife. We were married. I don't know the situation, but I'll say, let's say that 90% of the fault of the marriage failing is on the wife. Just for argument's sake, I've left her, I'm now with this other wife. I think that God is telling me that it's wrong for me to leave wife one and go to wife two. I think it's wrong. Well, then for you, it is wrong. For you, it is wrong. So you have two choices if you come up with a situation that you think is right. And it can be dangerous. The first one is an easy one, which is then do what your conscience tells you to do. Right? That's the, when I say easy, that's the simple solution. The trickier solution is turning around and saying, okay, wait a minute. Is this a case of like meat that has been sacrificed to idols? This is something that may not be wrong in actuality. I just think it's wrong. What's the danger with this approach? Anybody? What would you imagine is the danger with this approach?
Rationalizing?
It leaves you very much open to rationalizing. And Mike Minter will tell you without telling the story of a guy that came to him and said, that was in this church and said, hey, I feel like God's, I've read Romans, I forget what chapter, maybe 7, 8 or 10, and it seems to me like God's telling me to leave my wife. And Mike's like, what verse was that? I missed that particular part of Romans.
Joe, leave Mary.
So it is if you are a sufficiently creative and intelligent enough person, you might be able to justify your way out of absolutely anything. And this guy was a clever fellow, and he did. Now, I think most people would say it would be an interesting interpretation out of Romans specifically that leaving your wife is the right thing to do. But what I would say then is if you're going to do that, you do it with a good and pure heart. And what do you want to do if you're afraid that you might justify your way out of doing something that's right? What's the safest thing to do? How do you make a decision like that?
Consult someone.
Bingo. Is you know, you ought to be able to say about yourself that it's impossible that I'd be objective in this case. I am so closely tied to the situation, I'm subjective by definition. So let me find somebody that's going to be closer to objective. And this is counselors that you would look at and say things like this. I don't know what God's will is in this one. I'm asking him, and you have something else. That's the obvious, right? We pray about this, we ask God, we read the scriptures, and we say. But you wouldn't have the question if you weren't reading the scriptures, because the only reason for that conflict is specifically out of the scriptures. So you go to somebody that you're like, and this is how I would pick them. That guy right there may not know a bunch of stuff, but I know one thing. He's got a good heart for God. And because I don't see him making choices in his life that are wrong. Frequently, you know, that he's a relatively good man. He seems like he's living like God wants him to live, or she is living like God wants her to live in some particular way. In this case, I would have a discussion with another guy. So I think that's exactly the right answer, and that's what I would do, and maybe I would build a couple of them, a little council of guys that could advise me on this one, if it's such a big deal. Now, I will tell you that my reading of Scripture leads me to believe that God intends for us to have one wife, and that one wife, is it permissible to have more than one wife? Well, if it's not, then David's in trouble, right? David had several. So it might be permissible to have multiple wives, but it doesn't seem like one of the things that you can do is, and I'm not arguing for that, by the way, if anybody's wondering. I don't think that's the right way. I think Jesus said, one man and one woman, God put the two together, what God, we say in the wedding scenario, in the wedding ceremony, what God has joined, let no man separate kind of idea, including yourself. So walking away from someone to whom you have made a vow is something you should not do, because breaking a vow itself is something you should not do. So I think you're right to say that doesn't feel right. Now let's go, what does Jesus say about it? Jesus says that anybody that divorces his wife and marries another causes her to commit adultery. All right, so that to me, if I'm gonna single verse it, that's the one that I go to. I think there are multiple verses you can go to as well. Now this leaves us with a conundrum. And the conundrum that is usually brought up is this, and I don't know if this is the case or not. I'm not a Christian. My wife and I got married, not as Christians. We end up getting divorced. I then become a Christian. Jesus said, or Paul says, I'm a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things are become new. So since I'm a new creature, all those vows do not count. A lot of churches will counsel that that's the way that it works. Once you're a Christian, you're a new creature, none of those old things count. That doesn't seem to me to be supported by Scripture. In fact, some of the things Jesus tells people to do when they come up to him seem to indicate that that's not the right way to think of things. Not the least of which is, what would people think of the world if you can just go into Christianity and absolve yourselves of debts, marriages, treaties, all that kind of stuff? Christianity would get a bad reputation relatively quickly. So I don't think that's a good solution either. Now the question, and complicate it by, we're going to throw kids into the equation. You got kids by the first one, now you got kids by the second one. What do you do? What do you do? So this is all that I know. I would lay that down. From there on out, I would speculate. And the speculation that I would give you is this. God does not mean for you to have abandoned the first wife. Which one is truly your wife? I would say the first one is truly your wife. Now the problem is, you've also made a vow to the second one. So is the second one your wife too? This is where I'd have to raise my hands and say, God has not given me wisdom on this one, and I have not asked him for wisdom on this one. So I would pursue that one personally. And with your counsel of people, prayer, and searching the scriptures, you will come up with an answer. I can give you more later of what I think, but I would be exceeding my brief, I think, at that point. But does that stuff at least make sense? A couple comments, please.
I'm not sure where it is in scripture, but I think it's in Nehemiah where he was told to tell men to get rid of their wives who didn't believe in God.
Right, putting women away, and there was another commandment. So let me go a little bit into the nuance that I didn't mean to go into, just a little bit. Let's take the Catholic view of marriage to some degree. You are not married in the eyes of the Catholic Church unless you are married with the permission of the Church. Why is that? Because the Church is God's authority on earth, and the authority for marriage comes from God. It is God who gives this man to this woman, and this woman to this man, right? That is, it's God's. When you join to each other, you are doing so in the eyes of God, with the permission of God, to the purposes that God has for you as a joint couple. So what the Catholic Church will say is, if God has not given you permission, you may call it a ceremony, you may think that you're married, but in reality, you're just shacking up with a fake wedding certificate. That's the way the Catholic Church sees it. So if you haven't been married in the Catholic Church, you ain't married. Now, the same thing could potentially be said in either one of these situations, of either the first wife or the second, or both, depending on how that was done. et cetera. So that's some of the other nuance, but that's where that Nehemiah kind of stuff comes from, which is there was a command that says, do not take for yourselves foreign wives. This was to the nation of Israel, because they will corrupt you from the worship of the one true God, et cetera, et cetera. So what he's saying is, all of you got married outside the permission of the church, the analogy there would be. And so all of those vows were void because they were improperly founded. They are rulings that the judge did based on a bad interpretation of the law or a law that was unconstitutional. That's the idea behind it.
But that doesn't excuse you then from being an adulterer.
So, well, in this case, though, now here we are parsing the terms, but I think that it's interesting to do so. There's in the biblical terminology, there's a difference between fornication and adultery. Fornication is a whole range of sins that happen to be physical. Adultery is a specific one, which is I am married properly, and I go back on those vows and do something different. Generally considered to be physical as well, although Jesus kind of opened up for if you even lust, you're an adulterer. Now the interesting thing here is, it's easy to turn around and be like, well, here's a guy who's having to deal with this problem. And so we're on this side of the class, and appropriately so, here's this small table with these two. If the scriptures are true, though, raise your hand if you're an adulterer. If you believe what Jesus said about lust, that anybody who looks at a woman lustfully, has ever looked at a woman lustfully when they've been married, is an adulterer, looked at a married woman lustfully, you are an adulterer. So before we want to mentally be like, oh, this guy's having to deal with stuff, you got a whole class full of adulterers here, so don't pick up the stones and throw them just too quickly at this point, right? I heard a guy who spoke to the youth group, who part of his testimony is talking about he and his girlfriend at the time had an abortion. This was before they came to Christ. And Christians walk up to him afterwards and say very hurtful things to him sometimes, of like basically calling him a murderer. And he is very good about it, and he's like, well, what did Jesus say about someone who's been angry? Have you ever been angry with your brother? So if I'm a murderer, just remember you're a murderer too, so don't throw the stone quite so too hard. So a good point to think about, and something that Jesus has spoken on specifically, but doesn't necessarily fix your conundrum. You're just like, great, now I got a whole bunch of adulterers that are supposed to advise me on what to do, right? Yes, sir?
Just two points that I want to make. One, I think going back to the theme of science, when you talk about consulting with other people that you trust, I mean, that is scientific method right there, right? Going and consulting, not just with one person, because you could have a lot of bias in one person who knows you and wants to
This is peer review process, and right. This is why you try to publish in a reputable journal versus an unreputable journal, because you know that their review process is more rigorous and more objective.
So yeah, and I think we as Christians could borrow out of AA, because AA would say take it to 5 different people.
Right.
That you trust with serious decisions in your life. Get that kind of feedback.
So apparently it's not 3, now you got 5 to 5.
But when you're in a tough situation. The other thing that I would say is, I think societally we've bought into an idea, and I think most of us as individuals have bought into an idea that once there's divorce, that's it, right? And I think God holds open the possibility of reconciliation even for those people who are divorced. And it goes back to what we were talking about last week, is what's your Olympic lift
right.
when it comes to love? What is God calling us to do? Who is that person that we couldn't imagine we could truly love again? And maybe that's
I'll explain that term Olympic lift to those that are new here in a second when we get back to this. But go ahead, Carl. Sorry.
But that's all I want to say. Is maybe that's the person that's my Olympic lift is to be reconciled to a previous spouse even though there's been a divorce, and that's inconceivable to us.
Right.
I think often. Right. But God does all sorts of miraculous things in this world.
Yeah. And when the rich young ruler is asked by Jesus to leave all that he has, give it to the poor, and come follow him, because he'll have treasure in heaven. He walks away very sad, and Jesus says, what does Jesus say? Anybody remember? How hard it is for rich people to enter the kingdom of heaven. It is easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than it is for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven. And it says, and the disciples were amazed, and they asked him, who then may be saved? And Jesus replies,
what is impossible?
God can make all things possible. And I don't think he means all logically possible, impossible things possible, but things that are even logically possible, God can actualize. And so when we listen to it and you're like, I'm speculating, I don't know, but I'm thinking why I would leave a wife kind of thing and be like, the woman is crazy. It would be a bad thing to go back there. God can actually make it work out if the reason you're doing it is obedience to him. And I will point to, I think, the hardest one that we've heard in scriptures, and this is it Hosea? I always get the guy wrong. Is it Hosea and Gomer? So God tells him, go marry this woman of ill repute. She leaves him, runs around, and becomes a prostitute. And he goes back and brings her back. I mean, imagine telling a guy to go back into the inner city, into the brothels, and bring your now prostitute wife back into your home. How hard is that? Or imagine you're a woman the same way, you know, the other way around. That's tough, but he did it. Now, he doesn't lay that burden on everybody. That burden only goes to those who are strong enough to bear it. Because that's another promise God gives us. Is he will not allow us to be tempted beyond what we can bear, but with every temptation will provide a way out so that we may be able to bear it. So, congratulations, God thinks a lot of you, because you must be a tough guy or wouldn't have allowed you to be in this situation, I think.
It feels like a mental Solis. That's what it feels like.
And you know what? Whereas a Solis is something that is I think, unhelpful because it's cutting and it is harmful. There are still bounds that can work. There are still limitations you can put on yourself. And I'll give an example, because everybody know what a Solis is? Everybody heard of this? This was used by the monastic orders and wrote in the Catholic Church. It's a band that you can tie around your thigh or something else that actually cuts into you. And the pain of you feeling it is supposed to remind you to do certain things or be certain ways or whatever, that kind of stuff. I don't support the practice. It sounds like a terrible idea to me, honestly. But the idea is there a way to bind that part of you that does not desire the right thing in order to let you be free to do something else? Let me give you a couple of scientific examples. One of them, anybody ever watched a guy trying to learn to run faster? This is a running back for the Redskins. Since, according to Dennis, and maybe with some data points, they're currently the worst team in the NFL. If not by record, at least by spiritual reputation. If you've got a running back and he's already running a sub-4:40, but he wants to cut another 0.2 off because he wants to be fast, what do they do? How do you train him? What do you do? How do you make him faster?
Weight him down.
You tell him, yeah, you don't tell him just, hey, run faster. Put a parachute on him.
Right.
Now he's running as hard as he can and he's going at a quarter of the speed. And you say to yourself, that seems very unhelpful. The purpose is to run faster, and you just made him run 4 times slower. That's lunacy. Why does it work? Because if he's having to drive that hard against that increased load that he hasn't had to bear beforehand, his muscles will become bigger and stronger. And then when you release him from the parachute, now he's faster than he ever was before. So there are times when we can bind ourselves in ways that will build us. And those are the kinds of things to look for. I don't know if the Solis is the right way, and if you are perceiving it that way, or that's the way that it is, then know that that's wrong too. But it may be the case that there are areas of discipline into which one can gaze that is positive and helpful. So that, ask your team of 3 or 5 what that would be.
Okay, I'm divorced. I divorced my first wife, and I married my second wife. If I divorce the second wife and go back and remarry the first wife, if I now cure the adultery? Because I have a friend who did that.
Yeah,
my wife.
Right. Again, I don't.
Shut up.
I think that's a whole separate class. So I don't like deferring on a question, but let me at least answer it this way: if I were in that situation, I would feel that I had a burden to bear for both ladies. Now the question is, how do you sit down and figure out what responsibilities you have for both? And I would say this: if it is the case that you shouldn't have been married to either one of them, me personally, I would either have to get married to them properly, if that's meaningful to you at all. If it's not, then ignore it. But get married to one of them properly. But the other one, I still have incurred a debt to that I will never be able to walk back on. So it's not just child support. It's not just alimony. It would be something on the order of, I have an emotional responsibility. I have a support responsibility to you as well.
Did I cure my adultery?
It depends is the answer, but if that is what both you and the wives decided, then the answer might be yes to that question. But that is nuanced that we would have to answer. So I'm just giving you what my opinion is, but again, I ask everybody in this room, you can take that with a grain of salt. Worst kind of armchair quarterback, and there is, because I haven't had to walk in those shoes at all.
But I think Dennis's point gets at something that's a little off mark in the sense that when we can make amends for things that we have done in the past, that doesn't mean that I didn't sin in the past.
Right.
And I think that's important. So if you, in a sense, we can never undo the sin that we've done. We can do things to make amends for that, right? We can seek forgiveness. We can make it right with people in many ways. But that doesn't mean I didn't sin in the past. And I think that's something we always have to own. And again, each one of us sins every day.
Right.
That's something we just have to own, that that's part of what we are as fallible human beings.
And I think that it doesn't have to be a burden that one bears the whole time, because God does promise to help us with our burdens, and He promises they will be light. When you do things the right way and all are in agreement, you'll actually find that bearing those burdens is a joy. I know that sounds like lunacy, but it actually does work out. And for more examples of that, maybe this is a good subject for another class. But let's do your last question and then...
No, so there were no other questions, but I'm not looking for any kind of, you know, Christian absolution. What I'm looking for is the reconciliation between this desire for a loving reciprocal relationship and the secular outgrowth of that, which is usually a marriage, right? So is that now excluded from me, or do I have to change the definition of one or the other?
I'm not sure I understand the second part of the question.
Is future marriage out, or is a loving reciprocal relationship with a wife out?
If one and two, let's say, when you got married to one, did you get married to her with the same understanding that you would if you got married to her today? I.e., God is in charge,
Yeah, it was a Catholic thing.
Okay, so the most formalized version of it that there is.
Right.
So if you believe that and you think that that was legitimate, this is your wife. And when you left her, you abandoned your responsibility to her.
Go back to you.
This one right here, though, you also made a commitment to. So I almost look at it this way. Make it a little less personal, because now it's like me and you being like, you, dude. Here I am, and I joined the Marine Corps. Going back to the military, sorry. I walk on my commitment to the Marine Corps. I go AWOL. And I go move to another country, and I go into business with a guy. And we sign a contract, and I'm supposed to do business with him. Eventually, what's the right answer, the quote-unquote right answer, morally? If you made an oath that was a legitimate oath to somebody beforehand, you owe them that. But you also made a legitimate oath to this person too. Now, you were not free to do so. When this goes into court, what happens in court? What do we do in court if this was a guy getting married to one girl, and then he goes and changes his name and gets married to another girl? What's the court going to do?
They're going to find him guilty.
Of what?
Well, very possibly of
fraud.
They'll annul the second one and force the return to the first one.
He was not free to make this commitment. This was illegal to get married in this case. Now, the poor girl, maybe she didn't know, maybe she should check better, maybe I don't know what. But the bottom line is, she's the victim here a little bit. And it's easy to say that, but you know, what if the first woman was highly emotionally abusive, or so difficult to live with that it just seems impossible, that kind of thing. So these are the kinds of things that I'm saying. I haven't walked in those shoes. But what I would say is this: you cannot get rid of, at a minimum, you cannot get rid of this one. How this turns out is going to be a set of second-order decisions that depend on the first.
Right. So if the first one, if there was marital unfaithfulness, or if the first with the first one, or if the first one was an unbeliever, then is that an exception?
So my opinion is no, because Christ represents His own love for us, and then while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. So Christ made commitments to us before we made commitments at all. God makes commitments to Abraham without Abraham making a reciprocal commitment. If you make a commitment, regardless of what the other person's commitment is, you have to honor your portion of the commitment, unless God tells you otherwise. And we do see Jesus in some translations says, except for marital unfaithfulness. So she ran around on you and violated the oath, then you may have legitimate cause to have divorced her. So, you know, in this case, if she slept around on you, you actually can divorce her under the laws of God. Now the question is whether you can get remarried or not. Some say yes, some say no. That's way beyond, theologically, that's beyond me, because it's not an area that I've studied. Yes, sir, Miss Steve.
Steve, first one. Okay, Catholic Church canon law. I'm a former Catholic.
Yep.
And has some stipulations on how you can get an annulment based on some circumstances.
Right.
And subsequently going back and perhaps marrying your first wife, they also have some circumstances on that.
Absolutely right. It's not as cut and dry as I'm trying to make it.
I know this person.
In a short period. Yeah, right. Right. Okay. Well, then maybe you can advise me. Steve, and then I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yeah, there'll be a second. Sorry, I apologize.
So my follow-up question is, why is this an option?
Why is this?
What's the point?
What's the point of answering the question?
No, what's the point of doing the right thing?
What's the point of doing the right thing? In our decision tree, in our decision tree, the reason to do it is we want to be obedient to God. And maybe we can say the point is our own happiness.
It's already messed up.
It's already messed up?
You're already good, so I mean, how can you undo something that's...
Yeah, how can you already blown it?
It's done.
How can you undo it?
I don't see that at all as a reason not to do something in the future. Let me give you an example. We'll go back to our Olympic athlete thing that we keep using in here. You want to be an Olympic athlete. The coach has given you a set of training requirements, and he basically says this: you don't follow these training requirements, you ain't going to make it to the gold medal platform. It's not going to happen. This is what you have to do for you to make it there. And one weekend you decide, you know what, I'm tired of eating fish with the skin taken off. I'm tired of eating broccoli and asparagus or whatever it is they make you eat. And you're just like, I'm going to go eat a hamburger. And you eat a hamburger. Okay. You now disqualified from being an Olympic athlete? No. You shake it off. You do it. You try again. And you do a better job of it this time. And if what you said is, and here's the AA side of it, if the analogy there is, well, instead of eating a hamburger, I'm not doing well in the Olympic trials. I go and get absolutely, I turn myself into an alcoholic in a single weekend, which obviously you can't do probably, but let's say that's the case. Now you actually want support to help you out of that. So that may be a scenario when you bring some people on board, which is the kind of stuff that we're going to talk about in a second.
So your objection is to be convenient, not the right thing.
I missed the first
one. It's convenient, not the right thing.
Your objection is to be obedient.
Obedient.
Not necessarily doing the right thing.
What is the difference between being obedient and doing the right thing? There's no difference. They're identical.
Well,
if God is the one who sets the right thing, so...
If you're trying to look at the situation, what is the right thing for you to do? But what you should really do is say, okay, God, I messed up. It's under your control now.
Okay, so you say to God, I messed up. I think the question is this. Instead of saying, what's the right thing to do here, just say to God, look, I messed up. Help me out with this, right? Okay, well then what's God going to do? Is he just going to ignore you? Or is he going to tell you to do something? Is he going to give you a specific set of instructions? I think so. I think those instructions sometimes come from Scripture, and I think sometimes God arranges sovereignly for that structure, that advice of what to do to come from a council of wise, godly men or women and women. So the bottom line is you don't just quit and say, well, I sinned, I'm not going to do anything about it. Now, Jesus says specifically, if you are at the temple offering your sacrifice and you realize your brother has something against you, leave your sacrifice at the temple, go be reconciled to your brother, and then come back. The bottom line is obedience is what God wants, not sacrifice. He says that elsewhere too. So confession, yes, obviously confess your sin, because as even the secular side will tell you, semi-secular side of AA, admitting it is the first thing, right? You've got to admit you got a problem before you can fix the problem. But the bottom line is AA isn't a one-step process. I'm an alcoholic. Okay, well, I messed it up. The next thing you got to do is, all right, what's step two? What's step three? What's step four? You're walking your way in the process that Christians call sanctification into going from somebody who messes it up all the time to somebody who does the right thing all the time. That's the goal of discipline.
So
discipleship.
To touch on something you said, I would disagree that...
I'll come back to you. I forgot.
Actually, I cut in front of you. Go ahead.
I was just wondering, are we looking at this from the view of we are already married to the second wife, or we're looking to get married to a second wife?
Let's say we're already married to the second wife.
Okay. Right. Then I guess my second question would be, how is it right for us to break that commitment in light of, like, we... especially if we just became a Christian.
Yeah.
And we're doing it like completely different, like the cord of three strands is not easily broken.
Yep.
How is it right to break that commitment and go back to wife number one?
I'm not saying it is. What I'm saying is, while the law might annul it, while the Catholic Church might annul it, while canon law might annul it, I don't think any of them will tell you bear no responsibility to this person anymore. Bottom line is, you still have responsibilities to this person too.
Okay.
So are you saying that we get divorced to the, you're not saying that we get divorced to the second wife, and just that there is a responsibility that we have to the first wife, but we remain faithful to the second wife?
Unfortunately, this has gone way beyond what I meant it to do. I would say, let me answer your question. I want to put on your question. If I were in this situation as I understand it, and I don't understand the situation, all right, because this is one I'm creating in my own mind, it fits at least what I've told you. This is my wife, and this is the one back to whom I should go. And this wife right here, assuming that I didn't fool her and tell her I wasn't married, she knew I was married beforehand. So when I sit across the table from her and I say, from her I spent 15 years with now, and say, you know what, this is what God is telling me. This is what God, I feel, is in my heart from God. And this is what the scriptures that I think so. I did the wrong thing by marrying you, because this is what the scripture says. Now, if she turns around and says, that she could say a few things. I'm a Christian too, and she's like, you know what? I hate it, but that's true. You know, we did the wrong thing here. That's one possibility. That's a low probability possibility, right? The more probable one is arguments and tears and all that other kind of stuff. Another one is, hey, I'm not a Christian. I don't care what you have to say. Your silly laws don't mean anything to me. Let me tell you what we have. You have a certificate of divorce, and now you have a certificate of marriage. Your responsibility is to me. So you have to deal with all those things, and we don't have enough time to do that here for sure. But what I'm saying is, this is the wife. This one knew it at the time, unless you snuck around on her. So she actually bears some responsibility for the situation. To your earliest question, a good one, what part of your situation are you responsible for? Your circumstances you're responsible for. Both people in this one are responsible for this situation. Both of them entered it knowing that there was a previous marriage here, and that there, both of them would say, let me skip out of this one and ask a question I've never understood at all. Guy A, girl B. Guy A leaves girl B, his wife, and runs around with another lady who knows that she is the mistress. And then she decides to get married to this guy. The part I never understand is why this now girl C is ever surprised that this guy A runs around on her with another mistress. It never made sense to me. It still doesn't make sense to me. You stole the guy in the first place from this lady that was his initial wife. Why are you surprised when he does it again to you? You knew his character when you married him. So now that's a character-based argument on adultery that's intentional mistress type of stuff. This one is not that scenario necessarily at all. So, but the point here is this wife knows that there was an original thing in a divorce. So if she gets divorced from him again, which I'm not advocating is necessarily the case, but if she does, that ought not come as a surprise to her. Nor is it something that ought to be morally objectionable to her. Why should it not be morally objectionable that she get a divorce? Because she agreed with the original state of the divorce, of him leaving the first one. So apparently divorce is a legitimate thing to her, to wife two, because she said it was good for you to get divorced from wife one and to come and live with me. So then why is it no longer good to go back the other way? Now that you can make, I'm not saying that's where the moral lines lie up, but what I'm saying is that's what this person rationally has to think, and on pain of irrationality or on pain of hypocrisy, right? So just more stuff to throw in here. This is a very complex question. I had forgotten that principally this was concerned with marriage. So thank you. By the way, let us show some appreciation for his willing to put this stuff out in a very public forum and talk about it. So thank you very much for bringing it forward, because it definitely sharpens the question. But I now refer you back to the initial. And by the way, I'm happy to be on the advisory council if you need it, but maybe I'm not the number one guy to choose on that. Pick some other guys if I were
to. I'll be your counselor.
Can't you just ask for forgiveness and stay with the second wife?
It's possible, but the question would be this. If you made a vow to, if you have a business relation, if we have a business relationship and I break his contract, and I walk away with $10,000 of his money, and I turn to God and I'm like, oh God, please forgive me for that. I'm sorry. And I come back to him, I'm like, hey, don't worry about the 10 grand. God forgave me. How well does that go?
No, but I think the point is you could go back to the person and ask for forgiveness, right? Because if you're in that business contract and that person that you're doing business releases you from your vow, right?
Then that is entirely correct.
I wasn't getting that granular. I was thinking on a high level, so I was married to a second woman and it started haunting me about the first woman. Couldn't I just ask God for forgiveness and move on?
I don't think so. I think you'd have to ask the first woman or the second woman, depending on what your course of action was. Now, if they release you from the vow, If this one releases you from the vow, it's all good. If this one releases you from the vow, is she able to? Or is that God? Is that a vow to God? You know, to whom did you make your vow? I, in a moment of foolishness or bravery, you can depend on which one you want. When it came to me doing my wedding vows to my wife, I changed them literally at the last second and said, not as long as we both shall live. I said, as long as I shall live. Which means if she leaves me or she dies, I cannot get remarried. Because I promised that in front of God. So whether I should have said that or whether I shouldn't have said that is irrelevant. The bottom line is I did say that. So now it's wrong for me because I said before God, I will not take another wife other than this one to then get remarried. God willing, fortunately she's 6 years younger than I am. And I have had heart disease in my family.
And the women usually live longer than the men anyway.
Yes, and she certainly will. God willing. But at any rate, just something to keep in mind. Vows are, we don't think anything of vows anymore. Vows are not a thing in our culture. We're like, vow, what is a vow? A vow is saying, this is the way that it will be for my whole life, period. And you are not authorized to break it. God is very specific about those kinds of things. Now, I think there are some allowances that have to be made culturally. But if you go into a vow with an understanding of that's what it means, you are responsible to fulfill that. So I think a lot of this has to do with what you know at the time and what your conscience tells you, what you knew from your conscience at the time as well. I think that's also relevant. But anyway, we're basically down to 15 minutes left to cover the major points. And did you ask your question now?
So I guess two-pronged from something you just said and something you said earlier, I would disagree that being obedient and doing the right thing are synonymous.
Okay, what's the difference?
So I think in examples or scenarios, so let me paint a quick picture.
Yes.
Let's say, use the Marines as an example, you pledge your allegiance to them for life, right?
Right.
Let's say you're in war, you're taken captive, you're still a Marine. Second scenario comes up, the people that are keeping you captive say, unless you denounce your allegiance to the Marine Corps, I'm sorry, this is extreme, we'll kill 100 people if you don't.
Yes.
So I would say the right thing would be, all right, I denounce, save the people.
Right.
But the obedient thing would be keep your vow.
Now, in the case of the Marine Corps versus the people for whom, under whom you were captured, you have that conundrum. I don't think that you have that conundrum under this version of it. Because the problem with the Marine Corps is, despite what they would like to think and what they attempt to project, they are not omnipotent, nor are they omniscient. So if it is the case, the Marine Corps cannot come to your aid there. In what scenario can you construct where God cannot come to your aid, that knowing that you said, I am morally obligated, because he's a source of moral obligations, to do A, and you're told, well, to do not A, to do B, is, we know that has a greater moral good, we would say. A greater moral, it's either I can be accused of a sin or 100 people lose their lives. Is God aware of this conundrum? Now, his order to you was specific, do A. And we see this, by the way. You'll see, which is greater to, if you've been captured by ISIS and you're one of 20 Egyptian young men, Coptic Christians, and they say, renounce your faith in Christ or we will behead you. The greater moral good seems to be easy. Well, all I have to do is say, I renounce my faith in Christ and I leave, and I'm like, I did that under duress, not a big deal. That's not what I actually thought, doesn't count, and I'm going to go and live a life of good works, and the total moral good there will be greater than the one time of saying to Christ, I'm not serious about him, because I didn't even mean it when I said it. That, these guys went to their death over that. Now the question, do we accuse them of moral wrong for not having embraced what we think is the greater moral good? So what it boils down to, in my opinion, is, I think that God, if you say, I think that it is wrong to not follow the specific order of God here, even though it's going to cost 100 lives, are you morally responsible for those 100 lives? Who's the one taking the lives here? It's this group of bad guys here that are doing the shooting here. They have a responsibility to God, too. This arrow is not your business. This arrow is your business. So you're responsible to be obedient. This is my opinion. you're responsible to be obedient to what God commands you to do. God will take care of the rest. And it may be the case that he wants people to sovereignly, in his sovereignty, he wants people to die. I'll give you a reason why. When I finally did all the analysis, some people have heard this, when I've done the analysis down to, do I believe the New Testament to be true or not? So I can logically get myself to believing in God. I can get into believing in an omniscient, omnipotent, morally perfect being. I think I can get there from pure logic, from an ontological argument. So I'm convinced that there's a God. How do I know that Jesus is the Son of God? I would have to believe the New Testament is true. Well, why do I think that the guys that wrote the New Testament, that the guys who said they saw Jesus rise from the dead were in fact not lying, weren't motivated to do differently? My answer is this: they all went to their death over the truth of it. That is extremely convincing to a guy in 2015. And it's maybe that God allowed for that to happen, even though we would say, would Peter have been a greater commander of the church, so to speak, if he'd have lived longer? Well, probably yes. But look, what he didn't know is what would its impact be in the 2,000 years afterwards. At least one soul says it's because of the way Peter died and James and some of the others that I believe the New Testament to be true. So I know this is a hard thing, but I believe that the responsibility, lines of responsibility, have to be very clearly delineated. And you're responsible to be what you and God agreed on. That's your responsibility, and everybody else's business is everybody else's business. It may not be satisfying to you, but that's the way I see it.
So can you simultaneously, because I think that would, well, can yes. you simultaneously let those people die and love them at the same time?
Yes. Now, the hard, let's make it even harder. The hard thing is, what if it's not a bunch of random guys in the Marine Corps? What if it's your family? And what if the guy's got the gun to your head and all that kind of stuff? So you can always construct these scenarios that seem really, really difficult. But it seems to me that when those scenarios do get constructed, God gives the people the strength to get along in those. Now, I would say this is, and this sounds horrible, because I've got a two-year-old son that I dote on to a degree that's ridiculous. You know, I'm glad you guys don't see it, because it's absolutely obscene.
Thank you.
But if somebody came in, this scenario were there, and God willing, I did play it out in the way that I did not deny Christ, and they killed my son, they shot my son. What's the right reaction to that? If we believe that what the Bible says, what's the right reaction to my son is dead?
Forgive the guy.
Okay, let's say we do that. But why? What should I feel?
Anger.
Why?
Someone just did that to your son.
Okay, so morally I'm outraged. That's true. What else should I feel with regards to my son?
Comfort.
If you really do believe in what we claim to believe in, funerals have tears because of separation. We are sad because we are not now with those people, but they ought to be completely undergirded and laced with joy because we know we will be with them forever. It is a temporary parting. It is a tick on the clock, relatively speaking. That's hard to embrace. That's a very difficult thing. I haven't had to walk that path. So, you know, again, worst kind of armchair quarterbacking going on here. But at the end of the day, if you really believe what God says in the Bible, death is but a temporary separation for people who love God and are called according to his purpose.
Just quickly, this also goes back down to science. It goes down to language, logic, and epistemologies.
Yep.
Where you can start tracing down, in other words, when you had a feeling of something back when they invented a word, when the word was invented, you can actually see how that word was invented to bring a new meaning to it so that you can have an applied meaning.
Yep.
You know, because the emotion that you might feel in some situation or some circumstances, even though we've kind of trimmed that out and you know our culture and society is really trying to change meaningful meanings into things that are not so meaningful anymore. So when we try to do that, we can use science and logic to make determinations about how we apply those various things at various times.
Thank you for that point. Good one, too. All right. For those who have wanted to see a miracle in modern terms, I will attempt in 6 minutes to do the remainder of this class. If it happens, this is a credit to God, not to me, because I have no idea how we're going to do this. What we had asked for last time was come back. So that we want to love God and others. What we had said was, come back with a thing about God that we've said this, you have to know the person in order to better love them. The more you know them, the better you will be able to love them. So let's leave that there. And we ask you to pick somebody that was relatively easy to love. Don't pick the Olympic lift is like The analogy was if you were trying to lift a weight, you don't go and try to do a 600-pound deadlift the first time. You just start with the bar and warm up. So this is about starting with the bar and warming up. Who's the easiest person for you to love? Pick who that person is, and then come back with who that is, and then let's pick what you want to know about God. So I won't ask you to do this, but now, or say it out loud, but here's what I would like you to do if you're writing it down, if you're doing it. From this right here, from what you want to know about God, and what you, and let's say you already know who this person is. Let's start with the person. First, this week, you have a goal. This week, what you want to do is find out what matters most to that person. That's your goal this week, is whoever that person is you pick to be the object of your love, your practice in love here, what matters most to that person? Now that actually splits into two. And you may not know the one. The one is what really matters most, and what is what they think matters most. But if you want to know what moves a person, find out what they think matters most, because they have built their lives around it, whether they admit it or not. So find that out. That's the first step. What matters most to that person? The second thing you're going to do is say, what do you want? What are you going to do? What am I going to do to help them in the direction of what they think matters most, if what they think matters most is good? Okay, is this good? Or what matters most bad? If what they think matters most is bad, well, you've got something, then pick something else to work on. But ultimately, if what you're going to figure out, what can I do to help? And it can be simple. Doing to help. Okay? What matters most? What can I do to help? Now, in doing these things, you've had to do what we pointed out earlier was, for those that hadn't been here, we won't go through the science of it now, but basically, we don't make decisions on the grounds. We make decisions based on the values that we pick and we believe in prior to it. So when you see a guy who's hurt along the side of the road bleeding, you either help or don't help. You don't sit there and make the decision at that point. You've actually already kind of made the decision by what you think about people in that scenario. In the Marine Corps, we call this training. You train for what you're going to do, and when you encounter that scenario, you'll hear guys say things, the training took over, I just did it automatically. That's what we want to do. You don't want to be trying to make decisions on the ground. You want to make decisions ahead of time. So what you want to do is say, in what scenario am I going to help this person? And this is where meditation comes in. Meditation, I don't mean meditation like, you know, the popular conception of Eastern meditation. What I mean is you're going to sit and you're going to think. You're going to mentally work your way through, when I'm in this situation, this is how I'm going to do it. In the lifting thing, have you ever seen guys sit there and they close their eyes and it looks like they're practicing something? Or giant slalom racers beforehand will be sitting there and they'll be going back and forth down the course mentally in their minds. That's what you're going to do. You're going to go through the course mentally in your minds, and then here's the scariest part. You're going to do it. You're going to figure out what you can do that is loving for that person, that is benevolent and selfless for that person. You're going to figure out how to do it ahead of time, and then you're going to execute it. Just one thing this whole week. That's all you got to do, is one time this week, love somebody in a way that is selfless and benevolent, and it answers what they want out of their life. As long as it isn't a moral evil. You qualify it that way. Don't do moral evil for them. Okay, that's benevolent. On God, this is an easier one. Simpler one. What do you want to know about God? Want to know. Now, what's the obvious answer? I want to know X about God. Where do you go? The Bible, right. How successful has that turned out to be for you in the past? Is that hard to do or easy to do? The Bible is not an easy book to read in many ways. So there are two things that I would ask you to do here. And this is what we would actually do if we want to know something about something. Let's say the topic here is God. That's the most profound topic there is. Let's make this topic physics. I want to know something about physics. So say you got a physics question that can't be answered by the all-powerful internet. What are you going to do? Where do you go?
Physicist.
You pick an expert. An expert that you trust, that knows about that thing. So go find that. Find out who that expert is. You don't have to find them this week. But find who that expert is. As I told you last week, for the question I had, Alvin Plantinga was the expert. The greatest living Christian philosopher, that was the expert. There's no reason I should be able to see him. He's in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I emailed him. He's like, come up and see me. I wouldn't ask you my question. All right? God can do this for you. You want to know about God? He will take you. Be careful. He might take you to Grand Rapids, Michigan. But he will take you to where you need to go. So find an expert. And then, when we say study the Bible, what I want you to do in this case is, I assume that your question about God is probably addressed somewhere in the Bible. Don't just use the Bible. I'm not saying because the scriptures are insufficient, but because we are insufficient. We are not doctors of all the kinds of things that we need, linguistics and cultural knowledge and historical knowledge and all this other stuff. All that Bible is written in very specific circumstances. It's applicable for all time, but to understand it, you have to understand it the right way. If you are not hitting three things in here, if you don't touch these three things, I'm going to tell you you're not serious about your question. One is a Bible dictionary. That's a different one. It's one specific to biblical terms. One is the commentaries. And one is, and I like this one right here, Bible Hub. It doesn't have to be this one, but BibleHub.org or Bible.hub.org. What's the URL, anybody know? Bible Hub. If you Google Bible Hub, it lets you click on INT in there, and you can see original Hebrew or Greek, and it translates word for word in there. And then you can click on that word, and it'll tell you other places. Study it like you mean it, like you really want to know it. Pick one facet that you want to know about God and study that this week. You have to do both. Why do you have to do both? Top two commandments are do both. Love God first, and love your neighbor as yourself. So, miracle failed him. 60 seconds over time. So much for that. We'll go a little bit more into this last time. If that was too hurried for several of you, or for those that didn't come up, I'll lay my case out a little bit better. This question session went a little bit longer than I anticipated. So, I beg your indulgence, especially for those that are new. Come back, and you'll see a more normal class next time. And we'll run through how this works. But our goal in all of this is the following. We want to be good Christians. We want to be good Christians the way God wants us to be good Christians, not the way that we want us to be good Christians. And so I'll make the case a little bit more for that next time, and then we'll lay out what our next set of exercise regimen will be. Thanks for your patience, and I think we generally go out that door.